from Ostershalin," she whispered. 12 gods! Who have you been speaking to?"
Brandy mixes were a Tal Varrar peculiarity. Fine brandies from elsewhere, in this case the peerless Ostershalin of Emberlane, were mixed with local liquor from rare alchemical fruits, and there were none rarer than the heavenly white plum, then bottled and aged to produce cordials that could blast the tongue into numbness with the richness of their flavour. The bottle held perhaps 2 glasses of white plum Ostershalin, and it was worth 45 solari. "A few knowledgeable souls," said Jean, "who said you might appreciate a modest draught."
"This is hardly modest, master."
"De Ferra, Jerome de Ferra, at your service."
"Quite the opposite, Master de Ferra. What did you want me to do for you?"
"Well, if you'd really prefer to get to the nub of the matter, I don't have a specific need just yet. What I have are questions."
"About what?"
"Vaults." Guildmistress Galadine cradled her brandy mix like a new baby and said,
"Vaults, Master de Ferra? Simple storage vaults with mechanical conveniences, or secure vaults with mechanical defences?"
"My taste, madam, runs more toward the latter."
"What is it you wish to guard?"
"Nothing," said Jean. "It is more a matter of something I wish to unguard."
"Are you locked out of a vault, needing someone to loosen it up a bit for you?"
"Yes, madam. It's just..."
"Just what?"
Jean licked his lips again and smiled. "I had heard, well, credible rumours that you might be amenable to the sort of work I might suggest." She fixed him with a knowing stare.
"Are you implying that you don't necessarily own the vault that you're locked out of?"
"Huh. Not necessarily, no." She paced around the floor of her house, stepping over books and bottles and mechanical devices.
"The law of the Great Guild," she said at last, "forbids any one of us from directly interfering with the work of another, save by invitation, or at the need of the state."
There was another pause.
"However, it's not unknown for advice to be given, schematics to be examined, in the interest of advancing the craft, you understand? It's a form of testing to destruction. It's how we critique one another, as it were."
"Advice would be all that I ask," said Jean. "I don't even need a locksmith. I just need information to arm a locksmith."
"There are few who could better arm such a one than myself. Before we discuss the matter of compensation, tell me, do you know the designer of the vault you've got your eyes on?"
"I do."
"And it is?"
"Azura Galadine." The guild mistress took a step away from him, as though a forked tongue had suddenly flicked out between his lips.
"Help you circumvent my own work? Are you mad?"
"I had hoped," said Jean, "that the identity of the vault owner might be one that wouldn't raise any particular pangs of sympathy."
"Who and where?"
"Requin, the Sin Spire."
12 gods, are you mad?"
Galadine glanced around as though checking the room for spies before she continued.
"That certainly does raise pangs of sympathy. Sympathy for myself."
"My pockets are deep, guildmistress. Surely there must be a sum which would alleviate your qualms."
"There is no sum in this world," said the old woman, "large enough to convince me to give you what you ask for. Your accent, Master de Ferra, I believe I place it. You're from Talisham, are you not?"
"Yes."
"And Requin, you've studied him, have you?"
"Thoroughly, of course."
"Nonsense. If you'd studied him thoroughly, you wouldn't be here. Let me tell you a little something about Requin, you poor, rich Talishani simpleton. Do you know that woman of his, Selendri, the one with the brass hand?
I've heard that he keeps no other close to him.
And that's all you know?
More or less.
Until several years ago, said Galadin, it was Requin's custom to host a grand mask at the Sinspire each day of changes. A mad revel in 1,000 Solari costumes, of which his were always the grandest. Well, one year he and that beautiful young woman of his decided to switch costumes and masks on a whim. An assassin, she continued, had dusted the inside of Requin's costume with something devilish, the blackest sort of alchemy, a kind of aqua regia of human flesh. It was just a powder. It needed sweat and warmth to bring it to life. And so that woman wore it for nearly half an hour, until she'd just begun to sweat and enjoy herself. And that's when she started to scream. I wasn't there, but there were artificers of my acquaintance in the crowd, and they say she screamed and screamed until her voice broke, until there was nothing coming from her throat but a hiss, and still she kept trying to scream. Only one side of the costume was doused with the stuff, a perverse gesture. Her skin bubbled and ran like hot tar. Her flesh steamed, Master de Ferrer. No one had the courage to touch her, except Requin. He cut her costume off, demanded water, worked over her feverishly. He wiped her burning skin clean with his jacket, with scraps of cloth, with his bare hands. He was so badly burned himself that he wears gloves to this day, to hide his own scars.
Astonishing, said Jean.
He saved her life, said Galadin. What was left of it to save? Surely you've seen her face. One eye evaporated like a grape in a bonfire. Her toes required amputation. Her fingers were burnt twigs. Her hand a blistered waste. It had to go as well. They had to cut off a breast, Master de Ferrer. I assure you, you can have no conception of quite what that means. It would mean much to me now, and it has been many long years since I was last thought comely. When she was abed, Requin passed the word to all of his gangs, all of his thieves, all of his contacts, all of his friends among the rich and the powerful. He offered 1,000 Solari, no questions asked, for anyone who could give him the identity of the would-be poisoner. But there was quite a bit of fear concerning this particular assassin, and Requin was not nearly as respected then as he is now. He received no answer. The next night, he offered 5,000 Solari, no questions asked, and still received no answer. The third night, he repeated his offer for 10,000 Solari, fruitlessly. On the fourth night, he offered 20,000, and not one person came forward. And so the murders started the very next night, at random, among the thieves, among the alchemists, among the servants of the priori, anyone who might have access to useful information. One a night, silent work, absolutely professional. Each victim had his or her skin peeled off with a knife on their left side, as a reminder. And so his gangs and his gamblers and his associates begged him to stop. "Find me an assassin," he told them, "and I will." And they pleaded, and they made their inquiries, and came back with nothing. So he began to kill 2 people per night. He began to kill wives, husbands, children, friends. One of his gangs rebelled, and they were found dead the next morning, all of them. He tightened his grip on his gangs and purged them of the weak-hearted. He killed and killed and killed until the entire city was in a frenzy to turn over every rock, to kick in every door for him. until nothing could be worse than to keep disappointing him. At last a man was brought before him who satisfied his questions. "Requin," said Galadine with a long, dry sigh, "set that man inside a wooden frame, chained there on his left side. The frame was filled with alchemical cement, which was allowed to harden. The frame was tipped up, so you see the man was half sealed into a stone wall all along his left side, from his feet to the top of his head. He was tipped up and left standing in Requin's vault to die. Requin would go in himself and force water down the man's throat each day. His trapped limbs rotted, festered, made him sick. He died slowly, starving and gangrenous, sealed into the most perfectly hideous physical torture I have ever heard of in all my long years. So you will forgive me," she said, taking Jean gently by the arm and leading him toward the left-hand window, "if Requin is one client with whom I intend to maintain absolute faith until the Lady Most Kind sweeps my soul out of this old sack of bones."
"But surely there's no need for him to know."
"And just as surely, Master de Ferrer, there is the fact that I would never chance it. Never."
"But surely a small consideration—"
"Have you heard," interrupted Galadine, "of what happens to those caught cheating at his tower, Master de Ferrer? He collects their hands, and then he drops them onto a stone courtyard and bills their families or business partners to have the bodies cleaned up. And what about the last man who started a fight inside the Sinspire and drew blood? Requin had him tied to a table. His kneecaps were cut out by a dog-leech, and red ants were poured into the wounds. The kneecaps were lashed back down with twine. That man begged to have his throat slit. His request was not granted. Requin is a power unto himself. The Archon can't touch him for fear of aggravating the Priori, and the Priori find him far too useful to turn on him. Since Selendri nearly died, he's become an artist of cruelty, the likes of which this city has never seen. There is no mortal reward that I would consider worth provoking that man."
"I take all that very seriously, madam. So can we not carefully minimize your involvement? Settle for a basic schematic of the vault mechanisms, the most general overview, the sort of thing that could never be specifically tied to you?"
"You haven't really been listening."
She shook her head and gestured toward the left-hand window of her house.
"Let me ask you something else, Master de Ferrer. Can you see the view of Tal Verar out this window?"
Jean stepped forward to gaze out through the pane of glass. The view was southward, over the western tip of the Artificer's Crescent, across the anchorage and the glimmering silver-white water to the Sword Marina. There the Archon's navy rode at anchor, protected by high walls and catapults.
"It's a very lovely view," he said.
"Isn't it? Now, you must consider this, my final statement on the matter. Do you know anything of counterweights?"
"I can't say that I..."
At that moment, the guild mistress yanked on one of the leather cords that hung down from her ceiling. The first notion Jean had that the floor had opened up beneath his feet was when the view of Tal Verar suddenly seemed to move up toward the ceiling. His senses conferred hastily on just what this meant, and were stumped for a split second until his stomach weighed in with nauseous confirmation that the view wasn't doing the moving. He plunged through the floor and struck a hard square platform suspended just beneath Galadine's house by iron chains at the corners. His first thought was that it must be some sort of lift, and then it began to plummet toward the street 40-odd feet below. The chains rattled, and the sudden breeze washed over him. He fell prone and clung to the platform with white-knuckled alarm. Roofs and carts and cobblestones rushed up toward him, and he braced himself for the sharp pain of impact. But it didn't come. The platform was slowing down with impossible smoothness. Sure death slowed to possible injury and then to mere embarrassment. The descent ended a bare few feet above the street, when the chains on Jean's left stayed taut while the others went slack. The platform tilted with a lurch and dumped him in a heap on the cobbles. He sat up and sucked in a grateful breath. The street was spinning slightly around him. He looked up and saw that the chain platform was rapidly ascending back to its former position. A split second before it drew home into the underside of Galadine's floor, something small and shiny tumbled out of the trapdoor above it. Jean managed to flinch away and cover his face just before glass shards and liquor from the exploding bottle of brandy mix sprayed over him. He wiped a good few solari worth of white plum Osterschalin out of his hair as he stumbled to his feet, wide-eyed and cursing.
"A fine afternoon to you, sir. But wait, don't tell me, let me guess. Proposal not accepted by the guild mistress?"
Jean, befuddled, found a smiling beer-seller not 5 feet to his right, leaning against the wall of a closed and unmarked two-story building. The man was a tanned scarecrow with a broad-brimmed leather hat that drooped with age until it nearly touched his bony shoulders. He drummed the fingers of one hand on a large wheeled cask, to which several wooden mugs were attached by long chains.
"Something like that," said Jean.
A hatchet slipped out of his coat and clattered against the cobblestones. Red-faced, he bent, retrieved it, and made it vanish again.
"You might call this self-serving, and I'd certainly be the first to agree with you, sir. But you look to me like a man in need of a drink. A drink that won't bust open against the cobbles and damn near break your skull, that is."
"Do I? What have you got?"
"Burgl, sir. Presuming you've heard of it, it's a Ferrari specialty, and if you've had it in Talisham, you haven't had it at all. Nothing at all against Talishani, of course. Why, I've got family in Talisham, you know."
Burgl was a thick, dark beer, usually flavoured with a few drops of almond oil. It had a kick comparable to many wines. Jean nodded.
"A full mug, if you please."
The beer-seller opened the tap on his cask and filled one of the chained mugs with liquid that looked almost black. He passed this to Jean with one hand and tipped his cap with the other.
"She does it a few times a week, you know."
Jean quaffed the warm beer and let the yeasty, nutty flavour flow down the back of his throat.
"A few times a week?"
"She's a mite impatient with some of her visitors. Doesn't wait to terminate conversation with all the usual niceties. But then you knew that already."
"This is pretty tolerable stuff."
"Thank you kindly, sir. 1 centira, the full mug. Thank you kindly. I do a brisk business with folks falling out of Madame Galadine's floor. I usually try to stake this spot out just in case it rains a customer or two. I'm very sorry you didn't find satisfaction in your meeting with her."
"Satisfaction? Well, she might have gotten rid of me before I expected, but I think I did what I set out to do."
Jean poured the last of the beer down his throat, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, and passed the mug back.
"I'm really just planting a seed for the future, is all."
Chapter 4. Blind Alliances. 1.
"Master Costa, please be reasonable. Why would I be holding anything back from you? If I had a treatment to suggest, it would mean a fair bit more gold in my pocket now, wouldn't it?"
Pale Therese, the consulting poisoner, kept a rather comfortable parlour in which to discuss confidential business with her clients. Locke and Jean were seated cross-legged on soft, wide cushions, holding, but not sipping from, little porcelain cups of thick Gereshti coffee. Pale Therese, a serious, ice-eyed Vardran of about 30, had hair the colour of new sail canvas that bobbed against the collar of her black velvet coat as she paced the room across from her guests. Her bodyguard, a well-dressed Ferrari woman with a basket-hilted rapier and a lacquered wooden club hanging from her belt, lounged against the wall beside the room's single locked door, silent and watchful. "Of course," said Locke. "I beg your pardon, madam, if I'm a bit out of sorts. I hope you can appreciate our situation. Possibly poisoned, with no means to tell in the first place, let alone begin securing an antidote."
"Yes, Master Costa, it's certainly an anxious position you're in."
"This is the second time I've been poisoned for coercive purposes. I was lucky enough to escape the first."
"Pity it's such an effective means of keeping someone on a chain, isn't it?"
"You needn't sound so satisfied, madam."
"Oh, come now, Master Costa. You mustn't think me unsympathetic."
Pale Therese held up her left hand, showing off a collection of rings and alchemical scars, and Locke was surprised to see that the fourth finger of that hand was missing.
"A careless accident when I was an apprentice, working with something unforgiving. I had 10 heartbeats to choose, my finger or my life. Fortunately, there was a heavy knife very close at hand. I know what it means to taste the fruits of my art, gentlemen. I know what it is to feel sickly and anxious and desperate, waiting to see what happens next."
"Of course," said Jean. "Forgive my partner. It's just... well, the artistry of our apparent poisoning surely left us hoping for some equally miraculous solution."
"As a rule of thumb, it's always easier to poison than it is to cure."
Therese idly rubbed the stump of her missing finger, a gesture that looked like an old familiar tick.
"Antidotes are delicate things. In many cases, they're poisons in their own right. There is no panacea, no cure-all, no cleansing that can blunt every venom known to my trade. And since the substance you describe does indeed seem to be proprietary, I'd sooner just cut your throats than attempt random antidote treatments. They could prolong your misery, or even enhance the effect of the substance already within you."
Jean cupped his chin in one hand and gazed around the parlour. Therese had decorated one wall with a shrine to Fat Sly Gandolo, Lord of Coin and Commerce, Heavenly Father of Business Transactions. On the opposite wall was a shrine to Veiled Azaguia, Lady of the Long Silence, Goddess of Death.
"But you said there are known substances that linger on like the one we're supposed to be afflicted with. Might they not narrow the field of worthwhile treatments?"
"There are such substances, yes. Twilight rose essence sleeps in the body for several months and deadens the nerves if the subject doesn't take a regular antidote. Witherwhite steals the nourishment from all food and drink. The victims can gorge themselves all they like and still waste away to nothing. Anuella dust makes the victim bleed out through their skin weeks after they breathe it. But don't you see the problem? Three lingering poisons, three very different means of causing harm. An antidote for, say, a poison of the blood might well kill you if your poison works by some other means."
"Damn," said Locke. "All right, then. I feel silly bringing this up, but, Jerome, you said there was one more possibility."
"Bezoars," said Jean. "I read a great deal about them as a child."
"Bezoars are sadly a myth."
Therese folded her hands in front of her and sighed.
"Just a fairy story, like the 10 honest turncoats, the heart-eating sword, the clarion horn of Therimpel, and all that wonderful nonsense. I'm sure I read the same books, Master de Ferrer. I'm sorry. In order to extract magic stones from the stomachs of dragons, we'd have to have living dragons somewhere, wouldn't we?"
"They do seem to be in short supply."
"If it's miraculous and expensive you're looking for," said Therese, "there is one more course of action I could suggest."
"Anything," said Locke.
the bonds magi of Carthane. I have credible reports that they do have means to halt poisonings that we alchemists cannot. For those who can afford their fees, of course.
Except that, muttered Locke.
Well, said Therese with a certain resigned finality, though it aids neither my pocketbook nor my conscience to set you back on the street without a solution, I fear I can do little else, given how thin our information is. You are absolutely confident the poisoning happened but recently?
Last night, madam, was the very first opportunity our tormentor ever had.
Then take what little comfort I can give. Stay useful to this individual, and you probably have weeks or months of safety ahead. In that time, some lucky stroke may bring you more information on the substance in question. Watch and listen keenly for whatever clues you may. Return with more solid information for me, and I will instruct my people to take you in at any hour, night or day, to see what I might do.
That's quite gracious of you, madam, said Locke.
Poor gentleman, I offer you my best prayers for good fortune. I know you shall live for some time with a weight on your shoulders, and should you eventually find no solution forthcoming, I can always offer you my other services. Turnabout, as they say, is fair play.
You're our kind of businesswoman, said Jean, rising to his feet. He set down his little cup of coffee, and beside it placed a gold solari coin. We appreciate your time and hospitality.
No trouble, Master de Ferra. Are you ready to go out, then?
Locke stood up and adjusted his long coat. He and Jean nodded in unison.
Very well, then. Valista will see you back out the way you came. Apologies once again for the blindfolds, but some precautions are for your benefit as well as mine.
The actual location of Pale Therese's parlour was a secret, tucked away somewhere amongst the hundreds of respectable businesses, coffee-houses, taverns and homes in the wooden warrens of the Emerald Galleries, where sunlight and moonlight alike filtered down a soothing sea-green through the mushrooming, intersecting elder-glass domes that roofed the district. Therese's guards led prospective clients to her, blindfolded, along a lengthy series of passageways. The armed young woman stood away from the door, a pair of blindfolds in hand.
"We understand completely," said Locke. "And never fear, we're becoming quite accustomed to being led around by our noses in the dark."
2. Locke and Jean skulked about the Savrola for 2 nights after that, keeping their eyes on every rooftop and every alley. But neither bonds magi nor agents of the Archon came forward and conveniently announced themselves. They were being followed and observed by several teams of men and women. That much was clear. Locke's guess was that these were Requin's people, given instructions to let just enough of their activities slip to keep him and Jean on their toes. On the 3rd night, they decided they might as well return to the Sinspire and put on their brave faces. Decked out in several hundred solari worth of finery apiece, they walked up the red velvet carpet and placed silver volani in the hands of the door guards, while a sizable crowd of well-dressed nobodies stood nearby hoping for a glimmer of social mercy. Locke's practiced eye picked out the ringers among them. Men and women with worse teeth, leaner faces, and warier eyes than the rest of the crowd, dressed in evening clothes that didn't look precisely tailored, or wearing the wrong accessories or the wrong colours. Requin's right people, out for a night at his Sinspire as a reward for some job well done. They'd be let in good time, but not allowed past the 2nd floor. Their presence was just one more component of the tower's mystique, a chance for the great and good to mingle with the dirty and dangerous.
"Masters Costa and de Ferra," said one of the doormen. "Welcome back."
When the wide doors swung open toward Locke and Jean, a wave of noise and heat and smells washed out over them into the night, the familiar exhalation of decadence. The first floor was merely crowded, but the second floor was a wall-to-wall sea of flesh and fine clothes. The crowd began on the stairs, and Locke and Jean had to use elbows and threats to make their way up into the mess.
"What in Perelandro's name is going on?"
Locke asked of a man pressed against him. The man turned, grinning excitedly.
"It's a cage spectacle!"
In the center of the second floor was a brass cage that could be lowered from the ceiling, locking into apertures in the floor to create a sturdy cube about 20 feet on a side. Tonight the cage was also covered with a very fine mesh. No, Locke corrected himself, two layers of mesh, one inside the cage and one outside. A lucky minority of the Sinspire patrons in the room were watching from elevated tables along the outer walls. It was standing room only for at least 100 others. Locke and Jean made their way through the crowd counterclockwise, attempting to get close enough to see what the spectacle was. The excited murmur of conversation surrounded them, more frantic than Locke had ever heard it within these walls. But as he and Jean approached the cage, he suddenly realized that not all of the noise was coming from the crowd. Something the size of a sparrow beat its wings against the mesh and buzzed angrily, a low thrumming sound that sent a shiver of pure animal dread up Locke's spine.
"That's a fucking stiletto wasp,"
he whispered to Jean, who nodded vigorously in agreement. Locke had never been unfortunate enough to encounter one of the insects personally. They were the bane of several large tropical islands a few thousand miles to the east, far past Jerem and Jeresh and the lands detailed on most Therin maps. Years before, Jean had found a gruesome account of the creatures in one of his natural philosophy books and read it aloud to the other gentleman bastards, ruining their sleep for several nights. They were called stiletto wasps on account of descriptions the rare survivors gave of being stung by them. They were as heavy as songbirds, bright red in color, and their stinging abdomens were longer than a grown man's middle finger. Possession of a stiletto wasp queen in any Therin city-state was punishable by death, lest the things should ever gain a foothold on Therin soil. Their hives were said to be the size of houses. A young man ducked and wove inside the cage, dressed in nothing more protective than a silk tunic, cotton breeches, and short boots. Thick leather gauntlets were his weapons, as well as his only armor. They were wedded to braces buckled around his forearms, and he kept his hands up before his face like a boxer. With gloves like that, a man could certainly contemplate swatting or crushing a stiletto wasp, but he would have to be very quick and very sure of himself. On a table at the opposite side of the cage sat a heavy wooden cabinet fronted with dozens of mesh-covered cells, a few of which were already open. The rest, judging by the noise, were crammed full of highly agitated stiletto wasps just waiting to be released.
"Master Costa! Master de Ferra!"
The shout carried across the noisy crowd, but even so was hard to pinpoint. Locke had to look around several times before he could spot the source. Maracosa Durenna, waving to him and Jean from her place at one of the tables against a far wall. Her black hair was pulled back into a sort of fantail around a gleaming silver ornament, and she was smoking from a curved silver pipe almost as long as her arm. Bands of white iron and jade slid against one another on her left wrist as she beckoned Locke and Jean across the room. They raised eyebrows at each other, but pushed their way through the crowd toward her, and were soon standing beside her table.
"Where have you been these past few nights? Ismila has been indisposed, but I've been cruising the waters with other games in mind."
"Our apologies, Madame Durenna," said Jean. "Matters of business have kept us elsewhere. We occasionally consult on a freelance basis for very demanding clients."
"There was a brief trip over water," added Locke.
"Negotiations concerning futures in pear cider," said Jean.
"We came highly recommended by former associates," said Locke.
"Pear cider futures?
What a romantic and dangerous sort of trade you two must ply. And are you as accomplished at stake-placing in futures as you are at carousel hazard?
It stands to reason, said Jean, or else we wouldn't have the funds to play carousel hazard.
Well, then, how about a demonstration? The cage duel. Which participant do you believe to have a happier prospect for the future?
In the cage, the free stiletto wasp darted toward the young man, who swatted it out of the air and crushed it beneath one of his boots with an audible juicy crack. Most of the crowd cheered.
Apparently it's too late for our opinion to matter one way or the other, said Locke. Or is there more to the show?
The show's only just started, Master Custer. That hive has 120 cells. There's a clockwork device opening the doors, mostly at random. He might get one at a time. He might get six. Eye-catching, isn't it? He can't leave the cage until he's got 120 wasps dead at his feet. Or...
She punctuated the sentence with a deep intake of smoke from her pipe and a raising of both her eyebrows.
"I believe he's killed 8 so far," she finished.
"Ah," said Locke. "Well, if I had to choose, I'd be inclined to favour the boy. Call me an optimist."
"I do."
She let 2 long streams of smoke fall out of her nose like faint grey waterfalls, and she smiled.
"I would take the wasps. Shall we call it a wager? 200 solari from me, 100 apiece from each of you?"
"I'm as fond of a small wager as the next man, but let's ask the next man. Jerome?"
"If it's your pleasure, madam, our coin purses are yours to command."
What a font of gracious untruths you two are.
She beckoned one of Requin's attendants, and the 3 of them pledged their credit with the house for markers. They received 4 short wooden sticks engraved with 10 rings apiece. The attendant recorded their names on a tablet and moved on. The tempo of the betting around the room was still rising. In the cage, 2 more murderously annoyed insects wriggled out of their enclosure and took wing toward the young man.
"Did I mention," said Durenna as she set her pair of markers down atop her little table, "that the death of nearby wasps seems to excite the others to a higher state of frenzy? That boy's opponents will get angrier and angrier as the fight goes on."
The pair currently free in the enclosure seemed angry enough. The boy was dancing a lively jig to keep them away from his back and flanks.
"Fascinating," said Jean, working a series of specific hand gestures into his mannerisms as he craned his neck to watch the duel. There were a few creative uses of fairly limited signals in Jean's message, but Locke eventually sorted the gist of it out.
"Do we really have to stay to watch this with her?" He was about to answer when a familiar hard weight fell on his left shoulder.
"Master Custer," said Selendri before Locke had even finished turning, "one of the priori wishes to speak to you on the 6th floor. A small matter, something concerning card tricks. He said you'd understand."
"Madam," said Locke, "would be only too happy to attend. Can you let him know that I'll be with him shortly?"
"Better," she said, with a half-smile that didn't move the devastated side of her face at all. "I can escort you myself to greatly speed your passage."
Locke smiled as though that were exactly what he would have wished, and he turned back to Madame Durenna with his hands spread out before him.
"You do move in interesting circles, Master Custer. Best hurry. Jerome can tend your wager and share a drink with me."
"A most unlooked-for pleasure," said Jean, already beckoning an attendant to order that drink.
Selendri didn't waste another moment. She turned and stepped into the crowd, setting course for the stairs on the far side of the circular room.
She moved quickly, with her brass hand cradled in her flesh hand before her like an offering, and the throng parted almost miraculously. Locke hurried along in her wake, keeping just ahead of the crowd as it closed up again behind him like some colony of scuttling creatures briefly disturbed in its chores. Glasses clinked, ragged layers of smoke twirled in the air, and wasps buzzed. Up the stairs to the third floor. Again the well-dressed masses melted away before Requin's majordomo. On the south side of the third floor was a service area filled with attendants bustling about shelves of liquor bottles. At the rear of the service room was a narrow wooden door with a brass wall plate beside it. Selendri slid her artificial hand into this plate, and the door cracked open on a dark space barely larger than a coffin. She stepped in first, put her back against the wall of the enclosure, and beckoned him in.
"The climbing closet," she said. "Much easier than the stairs and the crowds."
It was a tight fit. Jean would have been unable to share the compartment with her. Locke was crammed in against her left side, and he could feel the heavy weight of her brass hand against his upper back. She reached past him with her other hand and drew the compartment closed. They were locked in warm darkness, and Locke became intensely aware of their smells— his fresh sweat and her feminine musk, and something in her hair like the smoke from a burning pine log. Woodsy, tingly, not at all unpleasant.
"Well," he said softly, "this is where I'd have an accident, right? If I had an accident coming."
"It wouldn't be an accident, Master Costa."
She spoke softly as well, as though it was some rule of the enclosure.
"But no, you're not to have it on the way up."
She moved, and he heard the clicking of some mechanism from the wall on her right. A moment later the walls of the compartment shuddered, and a faint creaking noise grew above them.
"You dislike me," Locke said on a whim.
There was a brief silence.
"I've known many traitors," she said at last, "but perhaps none so glib."
"Only those who initiate treachery are traitors," said Locke, injecting a hurt tone into his voice. "What I desire is redress for a grievance."
"You would have your rationalizations,"
she whispered. "I've offended you somehow."
"Call it whatever you like."
Locke concentrated furiously on the tone of his next few words. In darkness, facing away from her, his voice would be detached from all the cues of his face and his mannerisms. It would never have a more effective theatre of use. Like an alchemist, he mingled long-practiced deceptions into the desired emotional compound, regret, abashedness, longing. "If I have offended you, madam, I would unsay what I said or undo what I did." The briefest hesitation, just the thing for conveying sincerity, the trustiest tool in his verbal kit. "I would do it the moment you told me how, if you only gave me the chance." She shuffled ever so slightly against him. The brass hand pressed harder for a heartbeat. Locke closed his eyes and willed his ears, his skin, and his pure animal instincts to pluck whatever slightest clue they could out of the darkness. Would she scorn pity, or did she crave it? He could feel the shuddering beat of his own heart, hear the faint pulse in his own temples.
"There is nothing to unsay or undo,"
she replied faintly. "I almost wish that there were, so that I could put you at ease."
"You cannot,"
she sighed.
"You could not."
"And you won't even let me try?"
"You talk the way you perform card tricks, Master Costa, far too smoothly. I fear you may be even better at hiding things with words than you are with your hands. If you must know, it's your possible usefulness against your employer
and that alone that preserves my consent for letting you live.
I don't want to be your enemy, Selendri. I don't even want to be trouble.
Words are cheap. Cheap and meaningless.
I can't... Judicious pause again. Locke was as careful as a master sculptor placing crow's feet around the edges of a stone statue's eye. Look, maybe I am glib. I can't speak otherwise, Selendri. Repeated use of her proper name, a compulsion, almost a spell, more intimate and effective than titles. I am who I am.
And you wonder that I distrust you for it?
I wonder more if there's anything that you don't distrust.
Distrust everyone, she said, and you can never be betrayed. Opposed, but never betrayed.
Locke bit his tongue and thought rapidly. But you don't distrust him, do you, Selendri?
That's no godstand business of yours, Master Costa.
There was a loud rattle from the ceiling of the climbing closet. The room gave a last heavy shudder and then fell still.
Forgive me again, said Locke. Not the sixth floor, of course. The ninth?
The ninth.
In a second she would push past him and open the door. They had one last moment alone in the intimate darkness. He weighed his options, hefted his last conversational dart. Something risky, but potentially disquieting.
I used to think much less of him, you know, before I found out that he was wise enough to really love you.
Another pause, and he lowered his voice to the barest edge of audibility.
I think you must be the bravest woman I've ever met.
He counted his own heartbeats in the darkness until she responded.
What a pretty presumption!
She whispered, and there was acid beneath her words. There was a click, and a line of yellow light split the blackness, stinging his eyes. She gave him a firm push with her artificial hand against the door that opened out into the lamp-lit heart of Requin's office.
Well, let her roll his words over in her thoughts for a while. Let her give him the signals that would tell him how to proceed. He had no specific goal in mind. It would be enough to keep her uncertain, simply less inclined to stick a knife in his back. And if some small part of him felt sour at twisting her emotions, God's damn it, that part of him had rarely spoken up before, well, he reminded himself that he could do as he pleased, and feel as he pleased, while he was Leocanto Costa. Leocanto Costa wasn't real. He stepped out of the climbing closet, unsure if he was any more convinced by himself than Selendri was.
3.
Master Costa, my mysterious new associate, what a busy man you've been.
Requin's office was as cluttered as it had been on Locke's last visit. Locke was gratified to see his decks of cards stacked haphazardly at various points on and near Requin's desk. The climbing closet opened out of a wall niche between two paintings, a niche Locke certainly hadn't noticed on his previous visit. Requin was standing gazing out through the mesh screen that covered the door to his balcony, wearing a heavy maroon frock coat with black lapels. He scratched at his chin with one gloved hand and glanced sideways at Locke.
Actually, said Locke, Jerome and I have had a quiet few days. As I believe I promised you.
I don't mean just these past few days. I've been making those inquiries into your past 2 years in Tal Varrar.
As I'd hoped. Enlightening?
Most educational. Let's be direct. Your associate tried to shake down Azura Galadin for information concerning my vault. Something more than a year ago. You know who she is?
Selendri was pacing the room to Locke's left, slowly, watching him over her right shoulder.
Of course,
one of the high muckershits of the Artificers Guild. I told Jerem where to find her.
And how did you know that she'd had a hand in the design of my vault?
It's amazing how much you can learn by buying drinks in artificer bars and pretending that every story you hear is incredibly fascinating.
I see.
The old bitch didn't tell him anything, though.
She wouldn't have. And she would have been content at that. She didn't even tell me about the inquiry he'd made. But I put out the question a few nights ago, and it turns out that a beer seller on my list of reliable eyes once saw someone answering your associate's description fall out of the sky.
Yes. Jerem said the guild mistress had a unique method of interrupting conversations.
Well, Selendri had an uninterrupted conversation with her yesterday evening. She was enticed to remember everything she could about Jerome's visit.
Enticed?
Financially, Master Costa.
Ah.
I have also come to understand that you made inquiries with some of my gangs over in the Silver Marina, starting around the time Jerem visited Guildmistress Galadine.
Yes. I spoke to an older fellow named Drava, and a woman named... what was it?
Armania Cantazzi.
Yes, that was her. Thank you. Gorgeous woman. I tried to get past business and get a bit friendly with her, but she didn't seem to appreciate my charms.
Armania wouldn't have. She prefers the company of other women.
Now there's a relief. I thought I was losing my touch.
You were curious about shipping, the sort customs officials never get to hear about. You discussed a few terms with my people and never followed up. Why?
Jerem and I agreed, upon reflection, that securing shipping from outside Tal Verar would be wisest. We could then simply hire a few small barges to move whatever we stole from you, and avoid the more complicated dealings involved in getting a lighter.
If I were planning to rob myself, I suppose I would agree. Now, the matter of alchemists. I have reliable information placing you at several over the past year, reputable and otherwise.
Of course. I conducted a few experiments with fire oils and acids on second-hand clockwork mechanisms. I thought it might save some tedious lock-picking.
Did these experiments bear fruit?
I'd share that information with an employer, said Locke, grinning.
Leave that for now. But it does indeed appear that you've been up to something. So many disparate activities that do add up to support your story. There's just one thing more.
Which is?
I'm curious. How was old Maxillan doing when you saw him 3 nights ago?
Locke was suddenly aware that Selendri was no longer pacing. She had placed herself just a few steps directly behind him, unmoving. Crooked warden, give me a golden line of bullshit and the wisdom to know when to stop spinning it, he thought.
Well, he's a prick.
That's no secret. Any child on the street could tell me that. But you admit you were at the Mon Magisteria?
I was. I had a private audience with Stragos. Incidentally, he's under the impression that his agents among your gangs are undetected.
As per my intentions. But you do get around, Leocanto. Just what would the Archon of Tal Verar want with you and Jerem? In the middle of the night, no less. On the very night we had such an interesting conversation ourselves.
Locke sighed to buy himself a few seconds to think.
I can tell you, he said, when he'd hesitated as long as was prudent, but I doubt you're going to like it.
Of course I won't like it. Let's have it anyway.
Locke sighed. Head first into a lie, or head first out the window.
Stragos is the one who's been paying Jerem and myself. The fronts we've been dealing with are his agents. He's the man who's so keen to see your vault looking like a larder after a banquet. He thought it was time to crack the whip on us.
Faint lines appeared on Requin's face as he ground his teeth together, and he put his hands behind his back.
You heard that from his own mouth?
Yes.
What an astonishing regard he must feel for you, to give you a personal briefing on his affairs. And your proof?
Well, you know, I did ask for a signed affidavit concerning his intentions to rake you over the coals, and he was happy to provide me with one. But clumsy me, I lost it on my way over here tonight.
Locke turned to his left and scowled. He could see that Selendri was watching him keenly, with her flesh hand resting on something under her jacket.
"For fuck's sake, if you don't believe me, I can jump out the window right now and save us all a great deal of time."
"No, no need to paint the cobblestones with your brains just yet."
Requin held up one hand.
"It is, however, unusual for someone in Stragos' position to deal directly with agents that must be, somewhat lowly placed within his hierarchy and in his regard. No offence."
"None taken.
If I might hazard a guess, I think Stragos is impatient for some reason. I suspect he wants faster results. And I'm fairly sure that Jerem and myself are no longer intended to outlive any success we achieve on his behalf. It's the only reasonable presumption."
"And it would save him a fair bit of money, I'd guess. Stragos' sort are ever more parsimonious with gold than they are with lives."
Requin cracked his knuckles beneath his thin leather gloves.
"The damnable thing is, this all makes a great deal of sense. I have a rule of thumb. If you have a puzzle and the answers are elegant and simple, it means someone is trying to fuck you over."
"My only remaining question," said Selendri, "is why Stragos would deal with you personally, knowing full well you could now implicate him if put to persuasion."
"There is one thing I hadn't thought to mention," said Locke, looking abashed. "It is a matter of great embarrassment to Jerem and myself. Stragos gave us cider to drink during our audience. Not daring to be inhospitable, we drank quite a bit of it. He claims to have laced it with a poison, something subtle and latent, something that will require Jerem and I to take an antidote from his hand at regular intervals or else die unpleasantly. So now he has us by the hip, and if we want the antidote, we must be his good little creatures."
"An old trick," said Requin. "Old and reliable."
"I said we were duly embarrassed." "And so you see," said Locke, "he already has a means to dispose of us when we've served his purpose. I'm sure he feels very confident of our loyalty for the time being."
"And yet you still wish to turn against him?"
"Be honest, Requin. If you were Stragos, would you give us the antidote and send us on our merry way? We're already dead to him. So now I have the burden of two revenges to carry out before I die. Even if I do succumb to Stragos' damn cider, I want my last moment with Jerem, and I want the Archon to suffer. You are still the best means I have to either end."
"A reasonable presumption,"
purred Requin, growing slightly warmer in his manner.
"I'm glad you think so, because apparently I know less about the politics of this city than I thought I did. What the hell is going on, Requin?"
"The Archon and the Priori are gnashing their teeth at one another again. Now half the Priori store large portions of their personal fortunes in my vault, making it impossible for the Archon's spies to know the true extent of their resources.
Emptying my vault would not only strip them of funds, but put me in their bad graces. Right now, Stragos could never put me out of business without major provocation, for fear of initiating a civil war. But sponsoring an apparent third party to hit my vault, oh yes, that'd do the trick nicely. I'd be busy hunting you and Jerome, the Priori would be busy trying to have me drawn and quartered, and then Stragos could simply... Requin illustrated what the Archon could do by placing a bald fist inside an open palm and squeezing hard.
"I was under the impression," said Locke, "that the Archon was subordinate to the Priori Council."
"Technically he is. The Priori have a lovely piece of parchment that says so. Stragos has an army and a navy that afford him a dissenting opinion."
"Great. So now what do we do?"
"Good question. No more suggestions from you, no more schemes, no more card tricks, Master Costa?"
Locke decided it was a good time to make Leocanto Costa a bit more human. "Look," he said, "when my employer was just an anonymous someone who sent a bag of coins every month, I knew exactly what I was doing. But now something else is happening. Knives are coming out, and you can see all the angles that I don't. So tell me what to do, and I'll do it."
Stragos, did he ask about the conversation you and I had?"
"He didn't even mention it. I don't think he knew about it. I think Jerome and I were scheduled to get picked up and brought in that night regardless."
"You're sure?"
"I'm as sure as I can be."
"Tell me something, Leocanto. If Stragos had revealed himself to you before you'd had a chance to perform your card tricks for me, if you'd known it was him you were betraying, would you still have done it?"
"Well," Locke pretended to think, "I can't say what I might think if I actually liked him or trusted him. Maybe I'd just give Jerome a knife in the back and work for him if I did. But we're rats to Stragos, aren't we? We're fucking insects. Stragos is one presumptuous son of a bitch. He thinks he knows Jerome and me. I just don't like him, not a bit, even without the poison to consider."
"He must have spoken to you at length to inspire such distaste," said Requin with a smile. "So be it. If you want to buy your way into my organization, there will be a price. That price is Stragos."
"Oh, gods! What the hell does that mean?"
"When Stragos is either verifiably dead or in my custody, you may have what you ask. A place at the Sinspire assisting with my games. A salary. All the assistance I can offer you with his poison. And Jerome de Ferra crying under your knife. Is that agreeable?"
"How am I supposed to do that?"
"I don't want you to do it all yourself. But Maxilan has clearly ruled long enough. Assist me in enabling his retirement by any means you can or any means I order. Then I suppose I'll have a new floor boss."
"Best thing I've heard in a long while. And the, money in my account, locked away by your command?"
"Will remain locked away, lost by your own actions. I am not a man of charity, Leocanto. Remember that if you would serve me."
"Of course, of course. But now indulge me, please, in a question of my own. Why aren't you worried that I might be double-timing you for Stragos? That I might run back and tell him all this?"
"Why do you presume that I'm not playing you falsely on that very presumption?" Requin smiled broadly in genuine amusement.
"All these possibilities make my head hurt," said Locke. "I prefer card sharping to intrigue. If you're not on the up-and-up, logically, I might as well go home and hang myself tonight."
"Yes, But I'll give you a better answer. What could you possibly tell Stragos? That I dislike him, bank for his enemies, and wish him dead? So he'd have confirmation of my hostility? No point. He knows I'm hostile. He knows the underworld of Tal Verar is an impediment to him if he wants to assert his power. My Felantotsi prefer the rule of the guilds to the possibility of rule by uniforms and spears. There's less money in dictatorship by arms.
Felantotsi was a Throne Therin term for foot soldiers. Locke had heard it used to refer to criminals a few times before, but he'd never heard them using it among themselves.
All that remains, said Requin, is for your other judge to concur that you are still a risk worth taking.
Other judge?
Requin gestured toward Selendri. You've heard everything, my dear. Do we put Leocanto out the window, or do we send him back down to where you fetched him from?
Locke met her gaze, folded his arms, and smiled in what he hoped was his most agreeable, harmless puppy fashion. She scowled inscrutably for a few moments, then sighed.
There's so much to distrust here. But if there's a chance to place a turncoat relatively close to the Archon, I suppose it costs us little enough. We may as well take it.
There, Master Costa.
Requin stepped over and placed a hand on Locke's shoulder.
How's that for a ringing endorsement of your character?
I'll take what I can get. Locke tried not to let too much of his genuine relief show.
Then, for the time being, your task will be to keep the Archon happy, and presumably feeding you your antidote.
I shall, God's willing. Locke scratched his chin thoughtfully. I'll have to let him know that we've made our personal acquaintance. He must have other eyes in your spy who'll figure it out sooner or later. Best have it explained sooner.
Of course. Is he likely to bring you back to the Mon Magisteria soon?
I don't know how soon, but yes, very much more than likely.
Good. That means he might blather on about his plans again. Now, let's get you back down to Master Deferra and your evening's business. Cheating anyone tonight?
We'd only just arrived. We were taking in the cage spectacle.
Oh, the wasps. Quite a windfall, those monsters.
Dangerous property.
Yes, a Jeremite captain had a seed hive and a queen he was trying to sell. My people tipped off customs, had him executed, burnt the queen, and the rest vanished into my keeping after they were impounded. I knew I'd find some sort of use for them.
And the young man facing them?
Some eighth son of a titled nobody with sand for brains and debts to the spire. He said he'd cover his markers or die trying, and I took him at his word.
Well, I've got 100 solari on him, so I hope he lives to cover those markers. He turned back toward Selendri. The climbing closet again?
Only to the 6th floor. You can walk back down from there.
She smirked slightly.
By yourself.
4. When Locke managed to elbow his way back down to the 2nd floor at last, the young man in the cage was limping, bleeding and wobbling on his feet. 6 stiletto wasps were free in the enclosure, hovering and darting around him. Locke sighed as he pushed through the crowd.
"Master Costa, return to us just in time for the issue to be settled, I believe."
Madame Durenna smiled over the top of her drink, some milky orange liquor in a slender glass vessel nearly a foot high. Jean was sipping from a smaller tumbler of something pale brown, and he passed an identical glass to Locke, who took it up with a grateful nod. Honeyed rum—
hard enough to avoid Durenna's scorn, but not quite powerful enough to start beating anyone's better judgment down for the evening. "Is it about that time? My apologies for my absence. Silly little business."
"Silly? With one of the priori involved?"
"I made the mistake of showing him a card trick last week," said Locke. "Now he's making arrangements for me to perform the same trick for, a friend of his."
"It must be an impressive trick, then. More impressive than what you usually do at a card table."
"I doubt it, madam." Locke took a long sip from his drink. "For one thing, I don't have to worry about such excellent opposition when I'm performing a card trick."
"Has anyone ever tried to cut out that disgustingly silver tongue of yours, Master Costa?"
"It's become a traditional pastime in several cities I could mention." In the cage, the mad buzzing of the wasps grew louder as more of them exploded from their cells. 2, 3, 4. Locke shuddered and watched helplessly as the blurry dark shapes hurtled around the meshed cage. The young man tried to stand his ground, then panicked and began to flail wildly. One wasp met his glove and was slapped to the floor, but another alighted on his lower back and drove its body down. The boy howled, slapped at it, and arched his back. The crowd grew deadly silent in mingled horror and anticipation. It was fast, but Locke would never have called it merciful. The wasps swarmed the young man, darting and stinging, digging their clawed legs into his blood-soaked shirt. One on his chest, one on his arm, its abdomen pulsing madly up and down. One fluttered about his hair, and another drove its sting home into the nape of his neck. The boy's wild screams became wet, choking noises. Foam trickled from his mouth, blood ran in rivulets down his face and chest, and at last he fell over, twitching wildly. The wasps buzzed and stalked atop his body, looking horribly like blood-coloured ants as they went about their business, still stinging and biting. Locke's stomach revolted against the small breakfast he'd eaten at the Villa Candessa, and he bit down hard on one of his curled fingers, using the pain to assert some self-control. When he turned back to Madame Durenna, his face was once again placid.
"Well," she said, waving the four wooden sticks at him and Jean, "this is a tolerable salve for the wounds I still bear from our last meeting. But when shall we have the pleasure of full redress?"
"It can't possibly come soon enough," said Locke. "But if you'll excuse us for the evening, we've got some political difficulties to discuss. And before we leave, I'm going to dispose of my drink on the body of the man who's cost us 200 solari. Madame Durenna waved airily and was reloading her silver pipe from a leather pouch before Locke and Jean had taken 2 steps. Locke's queasiness rose again as he approached the cage. The crowd was breaking up around him, trading marker sticks and enthusiastic babble. The last few paces around the cage, though, were already clear. The noise and movement in the room around them was keeping the wasps agitated. As Locke approached the cage, a pair leapt back into the air and hovered menacingly, beating loudly against the inner layer of mesh and following him along. Their black eyes seemed to stare right into his. He cringed despite himself. He knelt as close to the young man's body as he could get, and in seconds half the free wasps in the enclosure were buzzing and batting against the mesh just a foot or two from his face. Locke threw the remaining half of his rum on the wasp-covered corpse. Behind him there was an eruption of laughter.
"That's the spirit, friend," came a slurred voice. "Clumsy son of a bitch, cost me 500 solari. Take a piss on him while you're down there."
"Crooked warden," Locke muttered under his breath, speaking quickly. "A glass poured on the ground for a stranger without friends. Lord of gallants and fools, ease this man's passage to the Lady of the Long Silence. This was a hell of a way to die. Do this for me, and I'll try not to ask for anything for a while. I really do mean that this time." Locke kissed the back of his left hand and stood up. With the blessing said, suddenly it seemed that he couldn't be far enough away from the cage.
"Where now?" asked Jean quietly.
the hell away from these goddamned bugs.
5. The sky was clear over the sea and roofed in by clouds to the east. A high pearlescent ceiling hung there like frozen smoke beneath the moons. A hard breeze was blowing past them as they trudged across the docks that fringed the inner side of the great gallery, whipping discarded papers and other bits of junk about their feet. A ship's bell echoed across the lapping silver water. On their left, a dark elderglass wall rose story after story like a looming cliff, crossed here and there by rickety stairs with faint lanterns to guide the way of those stumbling up and down them. At the top of those heights was the night market, and the edge of the vast roof that covered the tiers of the island down to the waves on its other side.
"Oh, fantastic!" said Jean, when Locke had finished his recounting of what had transpired in Requin's office. "So now we've got Requin thinking that Stragos is out to get him. I've never helped precipitate a civil war before. This should be fun."
"I didn't have much choice," said Locke. "Can you think of any other convincing reasons for Stragos to take a personal interest in us? Without a good explanation, I was going out that window. That much was clear."
"If only you'd landed on your head, you'd have nothing to fear but the bill for damaged cobblestones. Do you think Stragos needs to know that Requin's not as blind to his agents as he thought?"
"Oh, fuck the son of a bitch."
"Didn't think so.
Besides, for all we know, Stragos really is out to get Requin. They're certainly not friends, and trouble's brewing all over this damned city. On the asset side of the ledger," said Locke, "I think Selendry can be sweet-talked, at least a little bit, and it seems that Requin really thinks of me as his."
"Well, good on that. Do you think it's time to give him the chairs?"
"Yeah, the chairs. The chair.